Hello, everybody, and welcome to our weekly Course in Miracles study group. This is Corinne, and we are going to start, as we usually do, with just joining together for a brief period of meditation. In these earlier editions of the Course, the less edited editions, there is a quote that says, "Meditation is a collaborative venture with God." And so as we close our eyes and turn our attention within, let's just imagine that this is a collaborative venture with God. God is always here, and we are now bringing our minds to God. So turning your attention from without to within, and if you'd like, just taking a nice deep breath. And just imagining that your attention is turning to an inner altar. This quiet place within, and in our inner altar, in a way, you could say that we usually have idols and distractions and things here that we are preoccupied by. Let's imagine clearing the altar to have a nice open space in which we invite the Holy Spirit to come to us. And the Holy Spirit is already here, so really it's us meeting the Holy Spirit. And we're going to place one thing on our altar, and that is our willingness. Our willingness to see differently. Our willingness to experience miracles, and our willingness to loosen the world from all we thought it was. And as you offer your willingness to Holy Spirit, asking for that miracle instead. For a few moments here, just imagine we're just resting in God. Resting in stillness, beneath any distractions, beneath any fog, any thoughts, as if we're just sinking more deeply into our own being, into our own mind, and simply resting here. This holy instant we give to you. Be you in charge, for we would follow you, certain that your direction gives us peace. If we need a word, a thought, or a tranquil open mind, these are the gifts that Holy Spirit gives. And we gladly place Holy Spirit in charge tonight by our request. Take a nice breath in and out. And coming together to our perception of right here, right now. In this holy instant that we are joining together in. Alrighty, so last week, we did a special reading for Easter, so it's actually been 2 weeks since we have read from the section that we're at in the book, so I think I'll do a little brief recap before we dive into the rest of this section, but to find your place, so just a reminder, I'm reading from the CE, that's the Complete and Annotated Edition by the Circle of Atonement, and if you have any other edition, paragraph breaks might be a little bit different, the editing might be slightly different, but the message is still there. If you have the Foundation for Inner Peace Edition, you're going to go to Chapter 26, Part 7, Paragraph 6, And you're actually going to start with sentence number 6. It starts with the sentence, what relevance has preference to the truth? So that's FIP. If you have the Sparkle edition, I had it, and I lost it. Let me just look for a moment. My apologies. 1, 2, 3, 4. It looks like the paragraph breaks are different here. So in the Sparkle edition, you're going to go to page 611. At the very top of the page, it's within that first paragraph. Again, it's mid-paragraph. It begins with a sentence, what relevance has preference to the truth? So toward the top of page 611. And then the original edition by Course in Miracles Society is what relevance has preference to the truth? It is chapter 26, part 7, paragraph 50. And it's right in the middle, what relevance has preference to the truth. So just to do a quick recap, since we haven't, as I said, read this material in 2 weeks, the section in the CE is called a review of the laws of healing. In the other editions, the laws of healing, review of principles. So basically, I feel like the review of the laws of healing is a good title for this section. And basically, the ideas presented in this section we've heard before elsewhere in the course. So it is reminding us of a number of these healing principles. For instance, in the beginning of this section, it talks about how all sickness comes from separation. So our belief that we are separate from God is the cause of all sickness. And when this separation is denied, the sickness goes. So it touches upon that. It touches upon how guilt is asking for punishment because we believe we've separated, we feel guilty, and that is essentially where that unconscious guilt comes from in the mind. This section also then goes on to talk about God's answer, which is the Holy Spirit, how God's answer, the Holy Spirit, is eternal. The Holy Spirit, operates in time. But the laws of time don't affect the workings of the Holy Spirit at all. And then it also goes on to say that perception's laws must be reversed because they are reversals of the laws of truth. So, in other words, one of the aspects of healing is denying our denial of truth. What is not true is there for us to deny, literally to undo the mistake that we have made in our perception. So I'll begin next with what for me is paragraph number 6. I don't know if I actually said the CE edition. It's page 790, paragraph number 6. And mid-paragraph if you're reading from another edition. So here we go. What relevance has preference to the truth? Illusions are illusions and are false. Your preference gives them no reality. Not one is true in any way. And all must yield with equal ease to what God gave as answer to them all. God's will is one, and any wish that seems to go against his will has no foundation in the truth. Sin is not error, for it goes beyond correction to impossibility, according to the ego, by the way. Yet the belief that it is real has made some errors seem forever past the hope of healing and the lasting grounds for hell. I want to read that sentence one more time. Yet the belief that it is real, so the belief that sin is real, has made some errors seem forever past the hope of healing and the lasting grounds for hell. If this were so, would heaven be opposed by its own opposite, as real as it is? Okay, I'm going to pause here. So I actually really love this first sentence. I'll just say a few words, and then if anybody has questions or comments, please chime in. What relevance has preference to the truth? So in other words, truth is true always. Only truth is true, and only the truth is true. If we prefer one illusion over another, that doesn't matter because preference has no relevance to the truth. If it's an illusion, it's illusion, and it's false. So our preference for something doesn't give it any reality in truth. It gives it reality in our belief system, but it does not give it reality in truth. And that's exactly what the next sentence says. Not one is true in any way, and all must yield with equal ease to what God gave as answer to them all. It then talks about how the sentence, sin is not error, for it goes beyond correction to impossibility. Here, there is a footnote in the complete edition that says, this explains that, actually, it's referencing an earlier section. It's talking about how sin is an error seen as having real destructive effects and thus causing real and unalterable guilt. So this is why sin is really impossible, because reality cannot be violated, is what that footnote goes on to say. I think we can all probably relate also. The sentence that says, yet the belief that it is real, so yet the belief that some sins are real, has made some errors seem forever past the hope of healing and the lasting grounds for hell. So maybe you can think of a relationship in your life where somebody has just something, somebody has done something that's been seemingly so difficult to get past, so difficult to undo. You know, I can think of some family situations in my own family where some family members just can't let certain things go. We've made, you know, this error into a sin, into something that seems unforgivable. So this is just a belief, and it also says, if this were so, heaven would be opposed by its own opposite as real as it is. So I want to dive into the next paragraph because it sort of continues in this thought, but I want to pause here and just see if anybody has anything coming up, any questions or comments so far, any sentences even that stand out to you.
Just want to say I can relate to family members not wanting to let things go. That's all.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think that's like one of the most relatable ways
yeah.
that we can think about the ego's version of sin. It goes, you know, it's not just an error. It's just like, you know, it seems just unfixable, uncorrectable. And the Course is saying that there's no hierarchy in, there's no order of difficulty in miracles. So, yeah, thank you for that, Sandra.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a big one. Anyone else? Okay, I'm going to keep reading, and I actually want to share some from the footnote for this next section. So this next paragraph says, then would God's will, let me back up. This is a continuation of the idea that we just ended with in this previous paragraph. So it says in the previous paragraph, which we read already, yet the belief that sin is real has made some errors seem forever past the hope of healing and the lasting grounds for hell. If this were so, would heaven be opposed by its own opposite as real as it? Then would God's will be split in two, and all creation be subjected to the laws of two opposing powers until God becomes impatient, splits the world apart, and relegates attack unto himself. Thus has he lost his mind, proclaiming sin has taken his reality from him and brought his love at last to vengeance's heels. For such an insane picture, an insane defense can be expected, but cannot establish that the picture must be true. Nothing gives meaning where no meaning is, and truth needs no defense to make it true. Illusions have no witnesses and no effects. Who looks on them is but deceived. Okay, I just want to back up here for a second in this earlier part of this paragraph with this language about God's will being split in two, becoming impatient, splitting the world, relegating attack unto himself, losing his mind. This doesn't sound so good, right? And it's not true. I mean, this is the Course is saying that for sin to be real, this would have to be the case. And clearly, that's impossible. The footnote says, it's just a clarification of what we just read. The footnote says, the idea in this sentence and the previous one is that if heaven were truly opposed by an equally real opposite, then all creation would be subjected to the laws of two opposing powers, with God as the good power and sin as an evil, and sin as the evil power, both of them exerting their influence on the realm of creation. this situation would persist indefinitely until God becomes impatient and steps in to end the situation himself. He assigns to himself the function of attack and defeats sin by bringing vengeance down upon it. Yet by utilizing the aggressive means of sin or attack, he has become possessed by the very evil he sought to defeat. And that's that sentence, thus he's lost his mind. To bring his love to vengeance's heels is to force his love to obey vengeance. And I'll stop there. So that just clarifies the like insane picture of you know, what would have to be true for sin to be real, and obviously that none of this is the truth with what the Course is teaching us. So I'm wondering if there's any questions or comments about this. I kind of feel like we're getting into the heavier the heavier part of this section here tonight. How about we keep going? Let's read the next paragraph. Forgiveness is your only function here and serves to bring the joy this world denies to every aspect of God's Son where sin was thought to rule. Perhaps you do not see the role forgiveness plays in ending death and all beliefs that rise from mists of guilt. Sins are beliefs which you impose between your brother and yourself. They limit you to time and place and give a little space to you, another little space to him. This separating off is symbolized in your perception by a body, which is clearly separate and a thing apart. Yet what this symbol represents is but your wish to be apart and separate. I'm tempted to keep reading, but I'm going to pause. So forgiveness is our only function here. It serves to bring the joy this world denies to every aspect of God's Son where sin was thought to rule. So these beliefs, these mistakes in perception that we impose between our brother and ourselves limit us to time and place, limit us to a perception of this world. And it's saying that this idea of separation that we've accepted into our minds first is then symbolized by a perception of a body. So, again, we've had this idea of separation that we've accepted into our minds first, and that has played a role in our perceiving bodies. And I think this is pretty radical, that it's saying that the body represents your wish to be apart and separate, which I don't think the ego likes hearing that at all because we don't want to lose what we've made. I think that that's a pretty radical and pretty challenging statement to take in, that our bodies represent our wish to be apart and separate. But I do think it's important for us to be willing to see our desire to keep the separation going, to stay identified as bodies, because, I mean, even in just reading that sentence, that what this symbol represents is your wish to be apart and separate, I mean, I can feel a little resistance arising in my own mind to not wanting to let go of the idea of Corinne. So if you're able to touch at any level, any kind of resistance or any sort of feeling that arises, that's actually indicative of what this is exactly saying, that we desire to be separate and a thing apart. But we are all coming to see that that does not make us happy, that there's got to be another way, and so the answer is coming in this next paragraph about forgiveness, which I'm excited to get to. So this is heavy. If it feels over your head, it's okay. I'm just wondering if anybody has any comments or questions so far, or again, any sentences that stand out to you.
I'm just curious as to whether our bodies, is that the only function, the fact that we want to be separate for the body?
Well, remember, too, that there's a repurposing at play here when we turn to the Holy Spirit. So the ego's purpose for the body would be to stay separate, to stay, you know, to keep believing in all of this. But all of us, because we're doing this, you know, we're here, like we're doing this Course in Miracles thing, we've all turned to the Holy Spirit, and just that invitation then repurposes this and now gives the body a new function. So this is very much talking just about the ego's, you know, use for the body, not the Holy Spirit's use for the body. So the Holy Spirit's use for the body, as I'm sure we're familiar with, is to be that communication device, is to find and to perform miracles, to find and engage with our special function here, which is healing. So there are other purposes for the body under the Holy Spirit's perception.
Oh, okay.
Or the Holy Spirit's purpose, I should say. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Great. Yeah, it'd be kind of a drag if it was just like...
Yeah,
you know,
that's like...
Yeah, that's why this is kind of heavy. But there's good news. Definitely a different function is there. Okay, so let's read the next paragraph. Forgiveness takes away what stands between your brother and yourself. It is the wish that you be joined with him and not alone. We call it wish because it still conceives of other choices and has not yet reached beyond the world of choice entirely. Yet is this wish in line with heaven's state and not in opposition to God's will? Although it falls far short of giving you your full inheritance, it does remove the obstacles which you have placed between the heaven where you are and recognition of where and what you are. Facts are unchanged, but facts can be denied and thus unknown, though they were known before they were denied. So I love this first sentence, and I'm not going to try to find this in the other editions. I'm just wondering if the language is exactly the same. I love how it says, in the edition that I'm reading from, the very first sentence that we just read, forgiveness takes away what stands between you and your brother. Takes away is in italics, so it's emphasized. Forgiveness takes away what stands between you and your brother. So this act of forgiveness, of forgiving to the Holy Spirit, you know, when we give something to the Holy Spirit, this act of forgiveness wipes away, it closes the gap between ourself and our brother. It's the wish that we be joined with him and not alone, because joined is how we exist in truth. There is that, it's been likened to the image of a diamond where we're all one, but each facet of the diamond is its own unique, you know, angle, which you could say that holds true for us as well. So forgiveness is what we're learning in all areas of our life. I think one of the hardest places can be those family relationships where there have been things that seem unforgivable, and yet we are called in those most difficult relationships to still be miracle workers, to still take a stand for truth in a way that we're called to. So before I say any more, anything coming up for anyone? Any questions or comments or insights? I also love toward the end of this paragraph where it says, facts are unchanged, but facts can be denied and thus unknown, though they were known before they were denied. I just really like that because it speaks to the fact that there are that truth is fact, and just because it's unknown doesn't mean it's not there. It's unknown simply because of the obstacles which we've put in the way and our desire to still continue to see that gap in our brothers. You know, I've noticed this in my own life with some challenging relationships where these relationships can be really, really, really difficult, and I can feel myself wanting to pull away. And there's nothing wrong with pulling away, but is it a pulling away to totally avoid, or is it, you know, a temporary pulling away to pause and get quiet and tune in and ask, you know, for guidance in terms of how to handle something? And that's a space that I've been learning a lot about recently with some very challenging relationship situations in my family with, seeing that desire to pull away and then the desire to turn to the Holy Spirit and do something different. So I'm wondering what's coming up for you all, if anything. We are definitely not going to finish this whole section tonight because it's really long, but how about we read another paragraph? Salvation, perfect and complete, asks but a little wish that what is true be true, a little willingness to overlook what is not there, a little sigh that seeks for heaven as a preference to this world which death and desolation seem to rule. In joyous answer will creation rise within you to replace the world you see with heaven, holy, perfect, and complete. What is forgiveness but a willingness that truth be true? What can remain unhealed and broken from a unity which holds all things within itself? There is no sin, and every miracle is possible the instant that the Son of God perceives his wishes and the will of God are one. I want to read this first sentence again. Salvation, perfect and complete, asks but a little wish that what is true be true, a little willingness to overlook what is not there, a little sigh that speaks for heaven as a preference to this world which death and desolation seem to rule. So this is our little part. I have noticed in my own journey, and I feel like, you know, we just do this as course students in general, that we want to do more. We want to do it right. And this is so clearly saying that heaven asks but that we have a little wish, not a big wish, a little wish that what is true be true. Heaven is asking that we have a little willingness to overlook what is not there. Not complete willingness, not perfect willingness, not big willingness, but a little willingness to overlook what is not there. And a little sigh that speaks for heaven as our preference instead of the world. So again, just like a little sigh that speaks for us preferring heaven over the world, just a little bit. So that's not big. You know, it doesn't have to be perfect. It doesn't have to be complete. That's why we have the Holy Spirit. It's just that tiny little part that we're asked to play, to have that little bit of willingness for another way. That's our part. That's literally it. I think that we get trapped by thinking it's got to be more. Does that resonate with anybody? I'm wondering what's coming up. I love how it goes on to say, in joyous answer will creation rise within you to replace the world you see with heaven, holy, perfect, and complete. So if we tease apart this sentence, in joyous answer will creation rise within you. So here is something that happens. It's a change that's coming from within us. It's a different way of seeing that replaces the world we see with heaven, holy, perfect, and complete. We learn how to see with a new set of eyes, a different type of vision that's not the body's eyes. You know, I have a very specific example that I can share that just happened today. It just popped into my mind, and I need to write it down so I don't forget. There's a family situation, as I sort of indicated already, that's been ongoing and challenging, you know, at points. It sort of ebbs and flows throughout the years. And today, I was asked to do something, to kind of be an intermediary between two family members who aren't speaking. And typically I say no to that role, but I checked in and the answer was help. You know, the answer was yes. So I said yes, and the person asking the question didn't get the exact information that they wanted, so they asked me to ask again, and I felt my annoyance spike. I felt it go like, you know, I immediately wanted to, no, at first I did immediately text back and say, you know, I'll talk to that person. I'll find out that next time I talk to them. You know, I'm preoccupied right now. It wasn't mean or anything, but it was a knee-jerk in my mind, no. Like, it was a knee-jerk feeling like this person was sort of intruding upon my peace. I noticed that. I noticed that there was that knee-jerk response. I noticed that there was a defensiveness and an anger and a judgment arising in me. And when I was able to see that, and I got willing to breathe and to not respond again, because I think that person, yeah, then there was another text when I said, you know, I couldn't right now. They responded, well, when can you? Like, later today. And that's when I was like, okay, I need to not knee-jerk respond again, because I'm going to say something that is going to engage at the level of the ego, and I'm done with that. Like, when I tell you that I'm committed to breaking, I think, a pattern that's been in place for, like, eons, I'm committed. So I turned to the Holy Spirit. I got willing. I decided I was not going to reply until I had time, you know, to cool down and come from a place of true guidance. So I did not respond to the question of when will you, you know, when can you get this information? Will it be later? And then within, I have to write down the time sequence, within 20 minutes, I'd say, maybe it was less, of me deciding to not have that knee-jerk ego reaction, to turn to the Holy Spirit instead, that other family member who, you know, I had to get the information from called me. And I just felt, that might not sound like a big deal, but for that other family member to feel prompted to call me at that moment, and then I was able to just easily ask the question for the additional information, it was so easy, and I didn't feel any sense of strain or conflict in that. That, to me, was a message from Holy Spirit that, yes, you're on the right track with listening, you know, with pausing and slowing down and asking for guidance. I felt like that family member called because they got a little cosmic nudge to meet me halfway, you know, to meet me, to help me out, basically. So I was able then to relay that information to the other family member, and it was done and over, and I didn't keep the ego pattern going that's been going. Does that make sense? I'm hoping it does. And that's where, you know, this willingness sometimes is a big deal, because in the moment when we're triggered, when there's something going on that's emotionally intense, it can feel really difficult to stop, you know, to step out of that whirlwind, that I almost picture it as like a not a whirlwind. What do you call it when it's in water and it's like spinning down a drain, like a vortex kind of thing, like, you know, stepping out of that and not getting sucked into it. It can take some big willingness sometimes to not get sucked in. I hope that was helpful. I think concrete examples are always helpful when we're reading kind of abstract stuff like this tonight. And, you know, just to further build on that example, there's my wish in my willingness to not keep doing the ego dance. There is my wish, my desire to close that gap, to not perceive that gap anymore between me and my my brothers. And I got to tell you, it's taken me 40-something years to get there. So, yeah. Questions, comments, what's coming up for you? And if you're just absorbing everything, that's totally fine. How about we move on to the next paragraph? Paragraph, for me, it's number 11. What is the will of God? He wills his son have everything. And this he guaranteed when he created him as everything. It is impossible that anything be lost if what you have is what you are. This is the miracle by which creation became your function, sharing it with God. It is not understood apart from him and therefore has no meaning in this world. Here does the Son of God ask not too much, but far too little. He would sacrifice his own identity with everything to find a little treasure of his own. And this he cannot do without a sense of isolation, loss, and loneliness. This is the treasure he has sought to find. And he could only be afraid of it. I'm going to keep reading. Is fear a treasure? Can uncertainty be what you want? Or is it a mistake about your will and what you really are? Let us consider what the error is, so it can be corrected, not protected. I'm going to underline that because we're going to come back to that. Let us consider what the error is, so it can be corrected, not protected. Sin is belief. Attack can be projected outside the mind where belief arose. Here's the firm conviction that ideas can leave their source made real and meaningful. And from this error does the world of sin and sacrifice arise. This world is an attempt to prove your innocence while cherishing attack. Its failure lies in that you still feel guilty, though without an understanding why. Effects are separated from their source. They seem to be beyond you to control or to prevent. I'm tempted to keep reading, but I'm going to pause there. Okay. So we just read two paragraphs. The first one, what is the will of God? It's that God wills that his son have everything. And as we know, we've shut ourselves off to everything because we desired specialness, because we desired that separation. We were guaranteed everything because we were created as everything, and it's impossible that any of that be lost. So that's important for us to remember. In the second paragraph, is fear a treasure? Can uncertainty be what you want? Or is it a mistake about your will and what you really are? Let us consider what the error is so it can be corrected, not protected. I want to just pause here and really emphasize this sentence, considering what the error is so it can be corrected, not protected. This, to me, is why it's so important that we look at the dark stuff in our mind, to be like so brutally and radically honest about what flies through our mind on a fleeting, you know, in any fleeting moment, to look at our stuff in difficult relationships. So in this family situation that I mentioned, I have been looking and continue to look at my role in things, and sometimes it's not easy. It's very uncomfortable, but we're doing this specifically, like it says so beautifully here, to bring it to the light so it can be corrected and not protected. This is how we heal, and we need to have that radical honesty to do this and to also do it with the Holy Spirit instead of the ego, because the ego would love to just beat us up for things, but repurposed under the guidance of the Holy Spirit. We're bringing it up, which is a wonderful thing to see it so it can be healed and there's no cause for guilt. In terms of a review of just the fact that this section is a review again, it's bringing up this idea that the ego would say, that the world would teach that ideas can leave their source. The whole world, it says, from this error does the world of sin and sacrifice arise. This world is an attempt to prove your innocence while cherishing attack. So in other words, attack is in our mind, but we don't want to own it. We don't want to look at the dark stuff, and so it's projected outwards so we can see it out there. And we have separated then cause and effect, and therefore they're not going to stay. They're not. We can't heal when we're keeping cause and effect separate. Both cause and effect are coming from the mind, and that's where the healing has to happen. I don't have any concrete examples coming to mind at the moment. So if you do, please feel free to share. Or, again, if you have any questions or comments.
Hi, Corinne.
Hi, Deidre.
I was just thinking about what you were sharing about the willingness to have radical honesty and that it's often uncomfortable, and I'm just thinking of like experiences that I've had where it is really uncomfortable because where the ego, at least for me, where the ego thought system like can trip us up is like the ego thought system wants us to point the finger at our brother and go, no, you're wrong, I'm right. I get to cherish all the things that I think, and I need to, you know, keep my beliefs so that I can be right, basically. And I've found, for me, like, particularly when it's family, maybe not quite so much other people, but family particularly, it takes a lot to go really deep and look and go, what are my motives here? Because if there's any kind of like wanting to pin it on the other, or you know, wanting to make another brother guilty, then I know, you know, what thought system is in charge, and that being in that place is really uncomfortable, but it's also the only place where the release actually happens, being able to go there. So, yeah.
Oh, that was so helpful, Deidre. You articulated that so clearly, and I love what you just stated with what do I notice here? Like, there is that statement of radical honesty of what do I notice here? And so if I wrote down what you said, if you're trying to pin it on another, make the other brother guilty, in my case, it was wanting to attack, pretty much say, like, you know, I'm not playing the middle person here, like, stop. Like, you know, I noticed, what I noticed was that urge to, you know, defend and blame the other for putting, you know, asking me to be in an uncomfortable position. And you're absolutely right that we have to see that and then know that that's the ego thought system in charge. And then we have that choice. Are we going to continue down that path of keeping the ego, you know, thought system in charge, or do we want to pause and wait and try to get quiet? Because I love then how you just said, you know, that's the place where the release happens, like in that looking, in that discomfort. And so we need to have a very, at least I do, like I found for me, I have to be able to really tolerate that discomfort. Like I have to really be okay with feeling really uncomfortable at times, and it's not fun. I don't like it, but
yeah,
only with tolerating that discomfort can I move through it and come out the other side and be willing to not keep going with the ego thought system, you know, to not continue to engage. Because what I want to do is immediately get rid of the discomfort by defending myself or attacking back. That's how I want to get rid of that discomfort immediately. Like, no, it's not me, it's you. But if instead I can stay with that discomfort, and like I just said, like, and breathe through it is kind of like my best way of putting it. There's something on the other side of that that, in my experience, can come forth.
For me, like, and I relate a lot to what you're saying, but for me, it's like, if I'm feeling uncomfortable, it's almost like I've learned to use that to help me not to feel bad about myself, but to just, like, locate where I'm at. Like, if I'm feeling discomfort, then it's a pretty good indicator of where my mind is. And so once I know that information, then I'm empowered to make a choice.
Yeah.
Otherwise, I'm just, like, but before you notice that, you're kind of, like, flailing around.
Right, right, yeah. I completely agree. It's a great indicator. It's, you know, and it only lasts as long as our unwillingness, you know, to not want to choose the Holy Spirit. Like the moment we're like, you know, help, I feel like that moves us through the discomfort. In my case, I found for myself I had, you know, some unwillingness of not wanting to, I should say it this way. I noticed wanting to be right, and that was keeping me in the discomfort because I wasn't willing.
Yeah, and isn't there a part in the course where it talks about, like, something becoming intolerable? And I've noticed that a lot more, like, you know, discomfort becoming intolerable because we actually want peace. And so when we're not at peace, it's really noticeable, at least for me.
Yeah, I agree with you. And, you know, what you just said reminded me, I feel like I've probably shared it on this call before, but I was at a meditation retreat and the teacher was saying how, you know, put a grain of sand in the palm of your hand and you don't feel it, you know, like you wouldn't really feel a grain of sand in the palm of your hand, but put that grain of sand in your eye and you really feel it. And I feel like that's what you're saying, like that, you know, we become more and more sensitized to those fleeting thoughts, you know, those attack thoughts, the loss of peace. We start noticing it more and more, and we can therefore choose again.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's helpful. Yeah, I don't know the quote that you're. I know what you're talking about. I can't think of what the quote is.
I don't know the exact quote either. But
yeah. I know what you're talking about. That's awesome. Very cool. I just looked at the clock, and I can't believe we're almost at the top of the hour. So maybe that'll be a good place for us to pause in terms of reading. Anything coming up otherwise for anybody, or questions or comments or insights or examples?
I have a question for Deirdre. You said that you take the discomfort as a sign of where you are. And where do you say you are? Like, in ego? And what is your step after that?
Where do I say I am? Well, it's not really like I'm measuring anything. I'm just, like, noticing I'm not at peace. And I want peace. And so it's like, it's more like a noticing of feeling out of alignment with the truth of who I am, which is love. And so it has taken me a lot of practice, like, to notice the difference. You know, like, to be really comfortable with what I'm feeling, and you just even the practice of noticing it. And that's a personal thing, I find. Like, every person would probably describe it differently, but that's how it feels for me.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah, thank you for that. You know, it also, I'll just add to you, there's a course quote that just came to mind, and the quote says that discomfort is aroused to bring the need for correction into awareness. And initially, when I used to read that, I used to think, oh, okay, so the Holy Spirit is making me uncomfortable to bring the need for correction into awareness. No, the Holy Spirit does not discomfort us or shake us up or rattle us. We're uncomfortable. We experience discomfort when we're misperceiving, when we're out of alignment, when we're listening to the ego. Like, that has to come forward. And we become more and more aware that we're in discomfort. You know, if things previously used to make us happy, like for instance, I passed two young women on a college campus one day, and I heard the one say to the other, I love judging people. And, like, that's a good example where, like, you know, okay, she loves judging people. She feels, like, whatever, it makes her feel good about herself. Maybe fast forward years from now, and she might find that, like, now judging people, now she's actually aware that that, you know, arouses some discomfort because if you're, I mean, I don't need to explain how judgment makes us feel. I think we all know, but I think I hope that is clear. But I really like that quote. So it's not the Holy Spirit rousing the discomfort. It's that we're going to experience discomfort when we misperceive.
Exactly.
Yeah.
There's no reason for the Holy Spirit to ever be out of alignment. That's what I mean by like the feelings being a barometer of like how in alignment am I right now.
Yeah. Awesome. Yay. Well, thank you, everyone, for holding the space tonight. And we will continue next week. So I love you all, and thank you. Have a great night.
Thank you.
Good night.
Thank you.
Good night. Bye, everyone. Good night.